You're listening to All the Best. I'm Pip Rasmussen. Today's episode is all about people taking the law into their own hands. Some are shooting guns fully within the bounds of the law. Others are taking it upon themselves to change those laws. Our producer Tiger has a run-in with the Canadian Mounted Police. And we hear from a member of a citizens' police movement in Cairo. But first up, this piece is from Leona Hamid.
On the opening weekend of duck hunting season, a group of recreational shooters and a coalition of people opposed to native bird shooting converge on a lake in Victoria. Both sides are 100% convinced they're right. They believe in their cause so passionately that they wake up at 4 in the morning and wade into icy water and stand there for hours. One half of them shoot the native wildlife and the other half get in the way. They've met on this lake to clash every year for the last 30. The leader of the group is a guy named Laurie Levy. You would probably recognise him. He's on the news every year. He was a cameraman back in the 70s when he got involved in the whale protection movement.
So the whales were about 5 tonnes. They were pilot whales mainly. And we used to put them onto the backs of four-wheel drive trucks.
Right now, I'm standing with Laurie's rescue team on the edge of Lake Murphy. It's dark and so cold. Standing with me is another long-time campaigner, David Evans.
David Andrew Evans.
From what I can gather, David is an expert on strategy.
We won't be going in straight away, as we don't want to scare the birds up into the guns. That strategy changes from year to year, depending on what's going on.
It's not a simple matter of getting onto the wetlands and shooing away the birds, like I thought. It depends on the size of the lake, apparently, and also the location.
Right now, you've got two wetlands that are full of shooters, and the only areas we're with water. And essentially, they'll be flying from one wetland to the next. So we want to keep it down as much as we can and only use our visual ploys when necessary.
Another important factor is the species of bird that lives here.
Some species will continue to fly around the wetland. Pink-eared ducks, freckled ducks, which are a threatened species, don't leave the wetland when they're disturbed. They'll fly low, and that's why so many get shot.
Unless you have the proper licences, you're not allowed on the water until 10 a.m. But shooting starts at sunrise, so rescuers will head out before then and face hefty fines and court dates if they're caught. Getting into the water is the easy part. Getting out again without running into a police officer is more complicated. It's even harder if you're carrying out dead or wounded birds. The likelihood of rescuers running into trouble on the water because of this is pretty high.
Police do have concerns that some of the hunters are a bit fired up. And so it's very important that we don't get engaged in any of that, all right? The onus is on you.
It's nearly 7 and it's getting easier to see, but the cold is still biting at my face. I weave in and out of rescue teams discussing their strategies and testing their walkie-talkies. A song is played over the loudspeaker to boost their spirits. When I start to hear distant cracks, it takes me quite a while to realise that this is the sound of shooting. Hunting season is open. The whole morning has had a militaristic feel to it. The strategising and the equipment even.
We went out and bought $25,000 worth of the best ballistic goggles we could get, which are the same as the Defence Force uses over in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq.
Laurie made it clear when I first met him that for the rescuers, this fight is won on public perception, and utilising the media is a key part of that. It makes me wary of the ways the Coalition Against Duck Shooting try to frame the issue and what is taking place.
Our campaigns have always been media campaigns, and the power of the media to bring about social change is enormous. It's the most powerful weapon.
There are lines that I hear repeated by nearly every rescuer I speak to. One of the main ones is about empathy. It comes up again and again.
The brutality that's inflicted on those birds is just unacceptable. And the difference between duck shooters and rescuers is duck shooters have no empathy for their victims, and rescuers do have empathy for those birds.
At 8 a.m, an hour after shooting commences, Laurie gets arrested.
I got arrested over here.
Yeah.
For a $886 fine, banned for 3 months, and charged with obstruction. Four or five rescuers were coming off the water with a wounded bird, and a compliance officer was chasing them in a kayak, and he was yelling out for them to stop, and he was catching up to them, and if he had have caught them, he would have confiscated the wounded bird, he would have killed it. So as they went past, the kayak went past me, and I just grabbed the kayak. With all this violence and cruelty that happens out here, it's the rescuers who pay the price in court. And rescuers have been fined today $886, and a lot of them have been ordered off for 3 months. But, you know, we'll be back.
A little later in the morning, I meet Helen. She has a gaming license, so she's been kayaking around the lake, picking up wounded birds and bringing them into the vet tent. I notice her by the shore in a heated conversation with a compliance officer and a policeman.
My birds were taken off me. There was discussion between the officers about what I was going to be charged with. I haven't been charged with anything because I was acting lawfully.
The guy trying to charge her wasn't a stranger to Helen. She sees him pretty much every year down here.
I got called in by Rod Carter, who is a compliance officer.
I started to ask Helen whether she'll be down here again for the whole hunting season, or just this weekend, but she cuts me off.
It's a shooting season, it's right. Not a hunting season. Oh,
okay. I make the same mistake again when I refer to what she's doing as a protest.
I'm not here to protest. Mm. I am here to rescue and to retrieve dead and injured birds.
Yeah.
The shooters like to refer to us as protesters.
Yeah.
But the point is, we're not here to protest. We're not holding up signs and banners. We are here to rescue, and we are here to witness.
Language is really important, especially in the battle for public opinion. It's important to Robert Kritzman too, who is on the other side of the issue.
You've been hunting here long?
Well, since 7:20 this morning, yes, but I've hunted most of my life.
There are a number of reasons why he shoots.
First start, it was cultural. It started with my father and his father. I've been hunting for more than 50 years.
Shooters argue that actually they're part of the conservation solution.
I think we're certainly part of the conservation solution. You know, field and game hunters have been for years planting nest boxes. We are the first to identify the fact that lakes have been dried out and swamps have been reclaimed. We've been doing this for 50 years actually, 50 years of reclaiming swamp lands. It just doesn't benefit just ducks, it benefits all wildlife. Mm. There's, ibises, coots and geese, swans, they're all continuously just existing because of field and game hunters.
As I walk around the lake to speak to more people, a fight breaks out.
Semi-automatics you never got. Semi-automatics you never got. You achieved nothing.
Which pheasant stall do you got?
There are times during the day when it's hard to tell whether this whole thing is a stunt or not. It's certainly what the shooters think, but is it what's happening? I ask Helen what's the worst part about being on the water.
It's the powerlessness. It's the suffering and the powerlessness that are the really painful things. Seeing birds being shot and hearing these men cry out in joy at inflicting pain on an animal is horrible. And the fact that they're so happy that they've hurt something, and it just makes me so angry with this government that they, and I really thought if we had a female for an agricultural minister, that she would understand that this is male violence, and that they would put an end to this. I really thought Labor was something different, but they're not. They're just a paler shade of asshole. I think the ALP should rename themselves the Assistant Liberal Party.
Empathy. Is that what this all comes down to? Can you shoot a bird and also feel sorry for it?
Don't feel sorry for them. We're part of the food chain, and just as they are, you know, so taking a life is never a wonderful thing. But we eat meat. I enjoy the game. I enjoy the hunts. I enjoy the food on the table. Look, they're emotional. I can understand their perspective. I think they're misguided. I think they're emotional. There's no facts in their argument.
It's not the first time I've heard someone accused of making an argument on emotional grounds instead of a rational one. I wander back to the rescuers, wondering whether I should have gone harder on them. I asked Dave to refute Robert's accusation, but he says this instead.
Wounded birds are wounded birds, and to them, they're nothing. To us, it's a bird that actually feels, and it's filled with pellets. How can you... It's just seriously a lack of empathy on those blokes to have made such a comment like that.
By the end of opening weekend, the Coalition Against Duck Shooting collected the bodies of over 100 dead water birds. These include threatened species like the freckled duck. There's also a swan. Just like last year and the year before that, they lay them out on the ground before Parliament House and tell the assembled media that they will certainly be back next year.
That was Leona Hamid talking to both sides of the story, recreational shooters and duck rescuers. In 2008, a group of Sydney teenagers ran a social media campaign to free one of their friends from what they thought was wrongful imprisonment. There was just one problem. The friend whose freedom they were fighting for, Tiger Webb, was never in jail. He didn't need to be freed. This next story comes from Tiger. It's about a giant misunderstanding, the worst night of his life, and glow sticks.
Right up until we got into the squad car, I thought the whole thing was a joke. There I'd been, not seconds earlier, turning to my new friend Carlos from Venezuela. I'd been saying, stupidly, "Carlos, I don't think life can get any better than this." Seconds after I'd said that, I was kicked to the ground from behind by a police officer. My pants were around my ankles. Public urination, you see, is a crime in Vancouver. The thing they don't tell you about handcuffs, they're cold to the touch. They hang off a utility belt all day. Police officers don't have them in their pocket, so they're not warm by the skin. I guess that was why the whole thing seemed like a joke my friends were playing on me. It just didn't seem that real to me. It was only once we, like myself, my new friend Carlos, and probably another Australian, a guy called Tim, once we were all in the squad car together, sitting in a row like ducks, that I realised none of my friends had the kind of budget you needed to purchase a realistic-looking police car purely for a laugh. The officers told us that they were going to take us to jail to be processed. And I think around this time I started to plead a bit. You can't arrest me, my 18-year-old drunk brain searched around pop culture debris for a kind of sentence that would make sense when spoken in the back of a police car. This is a free country. Well, I guess that line only works in the USA because the Richmond County sheriffs were largely unmoved. Carlos, my new friend, told me this wasn't so bad. He was pretty obsessed with that, actually. It would become something of a theme that got repeated a lot in our burgeoning friendship over the next 10 hours of our incarceration. It's not so bad. As far as Carlos was concerned, in Venezuela, by the time the police got you in a car, you were probably dead. Carlos looked around. Usually, he said, at this point in Venezuela, we would bribe the police with some cocaine. Tim actually got pretty agitated at this point and said, "Carlos, man, you can't just say that. Everything we say is being recorded right now. You can't just bribe police." "But Carlos," I said, "we don't have any cocaine with which to bribe." Even Carlos had to concede that was a pretty good point. At the Richmond County Sheriff's Office, we were told to check in our personal effects while we were held overnight. This was easy enough. I was only in Vancouver for the 2008 World Ultimate Frisbee Championships. It was the last night, the night of the party, so I only had my driver's license and some dwindling Canadian currency on me. The party we'd all just been arrested at for peeing outside of was glow stick themed. Those were being given out for free. My arms were covered in free glow sticks. The correctional officer, I guess that's what her job title was, told me that we weren't allowed to bring anything inside the holding cell that would constitute a choking hazard. Reluctantly, I unplugged the little pluggy bits that are at the end of glow sticks and placed them in my personal effects bag. The chief genius and centerpiece of the Canadian correctional system, if my brief time within it is any indication, is its insistence on ironic punishment. My new friend Carlos, Tim, and I were all only in there for going to the bathroom outside, a violation of the law. And our punishment was to, for the night at least, be put in a holding cell with four or five other inebriated people, a single toilet right in the center of the room, and time. I didn't make any jail friends. I was always a bit angry about that, but being forced to watch grown men use the lavatory over an 8-hour period made it hard to make small talk. It was late at night in Canada, early evening Australian time. What I didn't know, and couldn't know actually, was that news of my incarceration was spreading like wildfire across the very nascent 2008 Facebook of the day. A few of my friends from school had somehow heard I was in a drunk tank. They had access to social media and they decided to campaign for my freedom. The Free Tiger Facebook group aimed to, well, free me from what it called the oppressive grip of Canadian law. It's about time, the group description said, that we fought for our freedom. The group, spurned on by a series of mass invites, quickly reached hundreds of members. Its founders refused to clarify at any point whether the whole thing was a joke. People thought I was actually in jail and for a serious crime. And soon, most of my family and all of my high school year grade were talking about it. "So hilarious," said Dom. "Wait, this isn't about Tiger Woods?" said Donna. "Haha, sorry Donna, I didn't mean to invite you to this group," said Alan, one of the group moderators. Nothing was happening in the holding cell, other than a steady stream of slowly sobering men using a communal toilet as punishment for their urine-based legal transgressions. After a few hours, I tried to see what my new friend Carlos was up to, but he was already asleep. He was right, I guess. It wasn't so bad. In the morning, we were all ushered out of the cell. We were all foreign nationals, leaving that day, so they weren't going to charge us with anything. Too much paperwork, someone yawned. Carlos and Tim, my new friends, left the station so fast they basically evaporated, and I was left to get back my personal effects alone. When you're held in a drunk tank, you get your things back in a sealed plastic bag to prove that no one tampered with it. There's a bunch of forms you have to sign before you can get them. It's weirdly bureaucratic. And it's a really strange thing to be presented with your entire worldly effects. I got back my ID with little optimistic me on it and my 20 Canadian dollars. I looked at the glow sticks. Like the night itself, they'd started off with so much promise, but were, by morning, just another regret. They didn't even, at this point, glow.
That was Tiger Webb, one of our supervising producers here at All the Best, which is what you're listening to right now. Today's show is full of stories about people taking the law into their own hands. This one comes all the way from Cairo.
I can write it for you because my first name is actually two words. It's not one word. Yeah. Abderrahman.
Mm-hmm.
A space. Hey, Ghazi. Let me tell you the story about, because I cannot tell a story from the medal.
Okay.
In January 2011, the reason the Egyptian revolution launched one of the main reasons for the revolution was the police, the way they were dealing with people. I know lots of people, they even were afraid of going inside the police station. Although, for example, you might have been stolen and you were knowing the thief, but you cannot go to the police station because you are pretty sure that the police, this bad guy is going to pay some money for the police guys, and then you're not going to get your right. In the best case and the worst cases, you might be put in the jail for some time. The first thing that the regime decided to punish us, they decided that there is no police anymore in the whole country. And actually, this really happened. Like, the police just disappeared within one night, in the night between January 28th and January 29th of 2011, the police disappeared all over the whole country. This was the worst night during the revolution, and the army took place everything in the country, but the army was just trying to do what they just can do. But they cannot do, they cannot cover, especially all the police before disappear, they released more than 40,000 criminals as a kind of punching the people. So the only one case that the army started to kill any bad guy in the street, killing or like stealing or whatever, to control the situation. But the thing is that the army cannot cover everywhere, cannot cover everywhere. So within just three days, me with some friends, we actually, all of us are working as a computer engineers. So mm-hmm. we decided to set up a website, which was the idea at the beginning, but it just started to get bigger and bigger. The website simply is called zabatak.com. Zabatak is a very Egyptian word, means I got you. Yeah. The main idea we launched this website is to just warn the people, like, as a kind of awareness. But the thing that started to be successful, some more famous people, he suggested that why not integrating that website with the army database, because the army still was controlling the country, and why not just integrating that thing with the database of the army so that we can let the army give us their all of their contact numbers in the whole province, in the whole area of the country. At the same time, everybody who is logging, and the system is working like that. Just you have somebody gets around your home, around your area, whatever. Just go to the website, log the crime, give the all details, and submit it, and it will come to us. At the same time, we were still missing a very important thing, which was the police. We might can control some of the bad guys, but we need some police, because in every day, you need some police people to manage the traffic. You need some people to manage the lots of things. And we decided at the same time we are going to have some kind of a civil police. And it's all depending on the volunteering from you, me, all of us in the whole country. And you're going to distribute the time as a kind of shift. Especially we had a curfew. You know, curfew means that you can walk in the street.
But later, like I've told you, like later on, especially after the Islamist president was elected, only like 6 hours after the announcement of election, we built another one because everybody was watching. He's an Islamist president, and so we set up this website because the president was called Morsi. So we called the website the Morsi Meter. Simply, this was to watch or monitor all of his promises before he's being elected, because he promised he will do some stuff in the, especially for the country, because of the all of the corruption was before in the ex-regime. So we just, after 6 hours, we launched this website.
Okay, and you've been monitoring Morsi on the website, as you've said. What kinds of things have you found?
Well, because, you know, like, there was so many corruption in so many things. Literally, the country itself might look strong, but the society from the inside was so corrupted and lots of problems we have. He actually started these promises, as you see, like, in security, like, I mean, the security is securing life of people, and the traffic, because we had a serious trouble in the traffic itself, And the bird here means the food, like securing the food with good prices and all that thing, and cleanness, and after all, fuel prices, and even securing the securing the supply of fuel, which sometimes it does not disappear, but the black market, they are controlling it much more than the official market. So these were like his first five sectors of promises, including 64 promises achieved. And over the first year, he actually was being fought by the old regime, because the old regime still had their own businessmen, because like most of the business in Egypt and most of the media and all of the things, they were owned by some guys who were supported and who actually were like the main people or the key persons from the old regime. So everybody in the power tried to put lots of obstacles and lots of barriers against his plans. But actually, he started to do well. He started to do well after a while, and people started to realize that the problem is not because he cannot do, but because the others are putting the obstacles against him. And that's why, at the beginning, people were kind of upset because he was not able to do as he said. But after a while, people started to realize that thing.
That piece was by Kim Tan. This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Leona Hamid, Tiger Webb, and Kim Tan. Our executive producer is Heidi Pett, my co-host is Michael Bryden, and I'm Pip Rasmussen. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. And if you want to hear more stories, visit us at allthebestradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Kilago wants to test my will tonight. My friends all sing until it's gone. These simple plans, they look all set to go. A calming chaser, heart be still. We live in a digital world. We move to the beat of each
meets.